and I continue to feel that there is a sort of moral imperative on the state to protect. And, you know, there are good biblical passages in Romans, etc., which indicate that, you know, that is a biblical principle. And most of the people that we were looking at, you know, were wanting to do bad things, and we were trying to stop bad things from happening. And I think that's a positive function for an organization and for the state.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to this edition of The Profile on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Tony Wilson and a writer for the sponsors of this show, Premier Christianity Magazine. As well as publishing the most widely read Christian monthly magazine in the UK, Premier Christianity has a daily feed of online news, opinion and reviews on their website, premierchristianity.com. This week on The Profile, it's a great pleasure to introduce Lord Evans of Weardale, who sits as a crossbencher in the House of Lords. He spent his professional life in the British Security and Counterintelligence Service, rising to be Director General of MI5. Since retiring in 2013, Lord Evans has served his local community as a school governor and the nation as the chairman of the Committee on Standards in Public Life between 2018 and 2023. More recently, he has taken up the role of Chairman of Trustees of the Halo Trust, which works across the world to remove landmines from former war zones. Lord Evans, welcome to The Profile.
Thank you very much for having me.
On The Profile, we usually start with a bit of a dive into the early life of a guest, but I like to just do a bridge into your professional life and your role in MI5. I wonder if you might just give us the very briefest introduction into what MI5 does and perhaps how it distinguishes itself from MI6 and how the two work together.
Yeah, well, we have three intelligence agencies in the United Kingdom. There's MI5, there's MI6, and there's also GCHQ. And the role of MI5 as the security service is to keep the country safe from threats like terrorism and espionage. The role of MI6, which people probably know better from the James Bond films, although those aren't a very accurate kind of account of what they do, but the role of MI6 is to obtain information overseas that can't be obtained by normal diplomatic means, and to act as the arm of government for activities overseas which go beyond the routine of embassy life. And the role of GCHQ is on the technical end of intelligence gathering, gathering technical intelligence, but also providing advice on cybersecurity. So part of their remit is the National Cybersecurity Centre.
So all these three agencies obviously must be working very, very closely together, because some operation starts in the international realm under MI6. It could end up within the UK itself, so passed over to MI5. Would that be crudely how the two would work together in an operation?
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, it is now particularly and increasingly over the last 20 years, a very integrated model. When I joined the service, which is now over 40 years ago, home and away, or domestic and abroad, were very different. But current communications, travel, etc., mean that you have got to work extremely closely. And all three agencies operate on an integrated basis. And I think it's fair to say, actually, that the integration model for the UK is probably as strong as you will find anywhere in the world. And I used to say when I was head of MI5, you can't work out what's happening in Birmingham or in, you know, Bradford or wherever, unless you also understand what's happening in Cairo or in Peshawar. So that integration between the different contributions the agencies give is extremely important.
Well, we'll unpack more of that a bit later, but what I'd like to do now is start back in your early life. And I wonder if you could just paint a picture of how life started for you, your family background, how faith fitted into that picture of family life.
Yeah, so I was brought up in Kent, and I have always been a Kent person. I still am. My mother was a teacher and a head teacher eventually. And my father was a chartered accountant, but he spent most of his life, certainly during the time that I was around, working for the National Trust, the heritage charity. And we lived in Kent, as I say, I have a sister as well. I went to local schools and quite a stable life. My family background in faith terms was Baptist. So we attended the local Baptist church, which was a very small sort of chapel Baptist congregation, which was warm and it was friendly, but it was a bit elderly, I guess, even in those days. But that was the that was definitely the activity every Sunday. So once or twice on every Sunday, you would be down to church.
And then through the week, was that an important dimension of family life between the members of the family?
I think there was an implicit Christianity built into the values. It wasn't the sort of family where, you know, we got together for morning prayers or anything of that sort. But my mother particularly, I would say, was definitely an active and believing Christian. My father, I think, was a believer, but being a rather conservative old style British gentleman, he didn't talk about those sort of things very much, or indeed about all that much really. But it was definitely a Christian environment, and quite a number of the rest of the family were also from a church background, and many of them were active believers.
Thinking about you as a future spy, I want to get a little bit of a handle on what sort of child you were in terms of whether you were adventurous, bookish, rebellious. How would you describe you as a child?
I think probably I was a fairly cooperative child. I think my mother, because she was actually a very skilled child wrangler, so to speak, was very good at making you do the things she wanted you to do without any great confrontations. I guess I was quite good at school. We did live in the country, and that, I think, gives you a bit of space, really. So I would go out and, you know, play with my air rifle or make kind of explosive things that went bang without that getting in anybody else's space at all. And I did roam around a great deal in the woods and the fields and all that. So in that sense, I did have a lot of leeway to go and do what I felt I wanted to do. I was a fairly active reader. I suspect I wasn't a particularly difficult child to bring up because I was willing to go with the system, or if I wanted to rebel, I did it privately and quietly rather than in your face.
Okay, so private rebellion. So there's possibly a little bit of an emerging spycraft there, I can imagine. At what point in your, say, in your older years as you're growing up, did you take on the Christian faith for yourself? Because it's one thing to inherit one's parents' faith. But I know you went to university at Bristol and met your wife at the Christian Union there. So at some point, faith must have come alive to you personally.
Yeah, I think I was undoubtedly influenced by, as it were, sort of, you know, weekly church life in the church that I went to. But when I was in my sort of later part of my teens, sixth form period, I got involved with a group of younger people who were very excited about their faith. I guess it was the early days of the charismatic renewal of that, the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, the point at which this became a very personal thing for me, something that was exciting and that was adventurous. And I was very involved in that group for 2 or 3 years, and that fed in to my time at university. And I had one of those, you know, interesting, what one might see as coincidences, or you might see as more than coincidences, that I went up to university thinking I want to find other Christians. And literally the first evening of of my university time, when I was in the Hall of Residence, I went into the queue for the dinner and a chap next to me, and we got chatting, and I said, you know, who are you? And he introduced himself, and it turned out that he was another person who was a Baptist. He came from about 10 miles from me in Kent. He was a very, very active and committed Christian, and we struck it off immediately and have continued to be friends. He went in to be a doctor, Pete Carter, and then went on to lead North Kent Community Church, and now leads Eastgate, the large church which also has a healing ministry and is involved with Heaven in Healthcare up in the Thames Gateway area near Ebbsfleet. So, you know, he's a distinguished Christian leader, and at university we were close friends and were involved together in helping to lead the Christian Union in the hall and then at the university level.
I have this picture then. You're obviously taking your faith very seriously. You mentioned to me in a previous conversation that you didn't particularly have an interest in theology itself, but you also admitted that you had a hefty academic reformed systematic theology. So there must have been something of a draw towards theology. What were you considering also as a potential future? Was there a potential church ministry for you work-wise in the future, did you think?
Well, I guess when I say I wasn't interested in theology, I don't see myself as somebody, particularly now, who is enormously enthralled with theology as a sort of academic discipline. I think, you know, at university, particularly involved in Christian things, then obviously one did take a lot of interest in Christian books and so on. I can remember the sort of the prestige tome to have was Louis Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, a great big, fat, heavy systematic theology in sort of reformed Protestantism. The trouble is that sort of thing is not actually all that gripping and interesting. I didn't find it all that gripping and interesting after the first little flush of enthusiasm. And I've always been struck by the fact that the Bible is almost the complete antithesis of that. It's a mixture of stories and history and poetry spread over a long period. It's in one sense very unsystematic, but it's very human. And I think that's a much more compelling way of thinking about issues of faith than perhaps trying to construct a kind of faultless architectural model of theology. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I finished at university. I was wondering whether I would be called into ordained ministry, but I was quite sure that wasn't what I ought to, go straight and do. I felt that even if one is called to that, it's better to have done something else first so that you can relate it to, work experience and the life that, almost all of us actually live. So I was looking for a job in London and career service and applied for two or three roles, actually. But the one that I got was then called the Ministry of Defence Independent Intelligence Branch, which was an extremely unilluminating little kind of leaflet that I picked up. It was in London. It looked as though it was the sort of thing I might be able to do. So I gave it a shot and they offered me a job. In due course, I turned up and lo and behold, I realised on day two, only on day two, that I'd actually joined MI5. This is 45 years ago or something. MI5 was very, very little known. Even less was known about MI6, and which the existence of which was not admitted publicly. And therefore, there is now a fairly good understanding of what the intelligence agencies do, and you can go on their websites and look at their sort of friendly FAQs and all that sort of stuff. There was nothing of that sort. This was still Cold War period. And I learnt subsequently that the services MI5's policy was anybody who actively sought to join MI5 was generally speaking debarred on the basis that they were probably a spy trying to infiltrate. So you could only join if you didn't want to, which is a slightly strange model in which we changed as we became slightly more open as an organisation.
We understand that you can't disclose any operational details, but it would be just interesting to know a little bit more about the reality of a spy's life. So you worked your way through the ranks. Presumably you've had a go at lots of different aspects of MI5 operations. How does an operation take shape over time? And I'm sure it's a lot less glamorous than we imagine it might be, but just give us a few little vignettes, perhaps.
Okay. Essentially, the job of MI5 is to, if there are individuals or groups in the UK particularly, who are a threat to our national security because of what they're able to do and intending to do, then MI5's job is to find out who they are, to find out what they are doing, and to stop them from doing anything that is harmful to us. And that's the intelligence task. And from that perspective, at any one time, if you look I mean, either on the counterterrorism side or on the counterintelligence side, there will be strands of intelligence, either from, you know, the police or from members of the public or from our existing operations or from foreign services saying, you know, you ought to be aware of this piece of information that we've got hold of, or from GCHQ or from MI6 or whatever, which are coming into several MI5 site. And what you have to do is to look at those. Some of them will be obvious nonsense. Some of them will, you won't be able to tell whether this is serious, and some of them will be quite compelling and concerning. And then you have to build some way of verifying what you are seeing. So effectively, it's almost like a triage process. You know, is this serious? And if so, what are we going to do about it? If we don't know, what tests are we going to run to make sure that we can make the right judgments? So that's the process. And individual groups of staff or desk officers will have their own areas of specialism, whether that's particular terrorist groups or particular intelligence organizations that might be a threat to us. So they will have that context and understanding. And their job, you know, MI5 is not fundamentally a sort of analytical service. It's fundamentally an investigative service. Their job is to look at all the material that is coming in, or indeed that we are creating ourselves, to follow up individual leads, run them to ground if we can, and to work out what can be done to stop anything bad happening. And we are also proactively, if there is a known group, I mean, in the old days, you know, with the IRA, for instance, we would make every effort to obtain information on them so that we could spot anything about them that, you know, anything they were doing which was threatening. So, you know, we would be looking for opportunities to talk to members of the IRA who might be willing to talk to us. We would be looking for opportunities to identify where they were talking to each other and seeing if we could overhear that. Sometimes following people around because we believe that they were doing things that we needed to know about. So you are really trying to build your information base, identify things that mean that you can reduce the risk, and then finding lawful and accountable ways, very often in collaboration with other organisations such as the police, to make sure that nothing bad happens.
I want to unpack this a little bit more, because coming into this professional life as a Christian, there are elements in which you have to be evasive, hide the truth, sending people undercover into communities and even into families. Did that worry you as a Christian? Should Christians object to this? Is it objectionable?
The paradox with the work of MI5 and the intelligence agencies is that it is at one level inherently intrusive. It does, in a sense, impinge on what in other circumstances would be, you know, the rights of people to live their private lives without anybody kind of poking their nose into it. But there is a balancing factor, which is that there are, sadly, in our community and outside our immediate community, people who actively want to cause damage. And I feel that, you know, and I always felt that the role of the service was to keep safe both our country, but really what that means is to keep safe fellow citizens from people who were wanting to do damage. So I felt, and I continue to feel, that there is a sort of moral imperative on the state to protect. And, you know, there are good biblical passages in Romans, etc., which indicate that, you know, that is a biblical principle. And most of the people that we were looking at, you know, were wanting to do bad things, and we were trying to stop bad things from happening. And I think that's a positive function for an organization and for the state. The risk is where that is abused, and either for political reasons or out of sort of bad judgment or whatever, that those very intrusive techniques are being used against people who aren't actually a threat. And that's where I think both the internal ethical health of the organization, the agency, and also the external accountabilities are really important. And as the head of MI5, you can propose that a particular intrusive action, you know, a microphone is put into somebody's house or something, but it's not within our power to do it without anybody else's agreement. So the legislation is very clear that MI5 can propose, shall we say, a microphone is put into the house of somebody that we strongly believe is a foreign intelligence agent acting against us. But that then has to be agreed by the relevant Secretary of State to give their sort of political approval to it. And then it is also approved by an independent judge to make sure that it is being done in accordance with law. And everything that is done, and this is the case today, it was less the case actually 40 years ago, but everything that is done today is done on the basis of law. So there are clear statutory provisions that say where there is a need to intrude onto the privacy of individuals because of the national security imperatives, you can only do so in accordance with this statutory arrangement. There are oversight mechanisms built into it to make sure that it's not being abused. And indeed, there is also the existence of the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament, who can review it from a parliamentary perspective. So there's nowadays a lot of accountability. There was less accountability when I joined 40-something years ago.
That's reassuring that there are these checks and balances that prevent the organisation and the government from becoming as dreadful as the people we're trying to protect ourselves from. And I suppose that's ultimately what we have to bear in mind. Do you think those checks and balances now prevent effective investigation? Are there times when you think, well, if only we could have done X or Y, we might have uncovered something earlier?
Well, there is undoubtedly a resource and bureaucracy overhead from this. I think it's a price worth paying myself. I mean, you know, one little sort of factoid is that when I joined the service, there was one lawyer in the service who also covered MI6 and also was the person responsible for the service's public profile. The service's public profile wasn't a very onerous responsibility because it didn't really have one. By the time I left, there were about, I think, 35 lawyers. So effectively a 70-fold increase in lawyers over a 35-year period, and probably, you know, the same again for the other agencies. So there is a great big overhead in terms of, you know, our, as it were, democratic overhead. But I think in terms of public confidence in the agencies, parliamentary confidence in the agencies, and indeed, I think, you know, within the agency, most of the staff feel that they want that set of ethical safeguards and so on to be there, because the sort of people that we aim to recruit are people who do care about democracy, do care about accountability, and want to be doing the right thing. So we're not pushing against the grain in having these procedures. Then, you know, occasionally you'll get somebody who finds it all very frustrating and, you know, why don't we just get on and do it? Well, the answer is twofold. First of all, these checks and balances make sure that the thing that we're trying to get on and do is actually the right thing rather than somebody's gut instinct. And secondly, if we don't work with the parliamentary and legal framework, then we won't work at all in due course, because we will lose public and political consent for what we do.
Mm-hmm. The survivors and the families of those killed in the tragic Manchester Arena bombing in 2017 are bringing a legal action against MI5. And their claim is that vital clues that should have averted the plot were not properly scrutinised. Being head of MI5 and working for MI5 is incredibly tough. You've inevitably got to keep silent about all your successes, but all your failures become immediately devastatingly apparent. Do we have to accept that MI5 and our security agencies more generally cannot keep us safe all of the time?
It's interesting, the level of, as it were, sort of risk that society is willing to accept. I think if you go back 30 years to the IRA period, it was accepted that, you know, you, some will be stopped and some wouldn't be stopped. And that was kind of seen as just the nature of things. I think there's a much higher level of expectation now that everything should be stopped, all tax and so on should be stopped. Obviously, that is the aspiration, and people join MI5 and work in MI5 because they want to keep the country safe. And on the whole, I think the service would be seen as quite a professional and effective organisation. But sometimes things won't go right. And I think the service have been quite open, and the current Director General has been quite open about the fact that not everything necessarily was done quite right in that Manchester case. And I'm sure that the service and the people involved feel that very deeply, because, you know, they would have been giving their time and their effort and all their commitment to trying to get this right. And then, you know, something doesn't go quite right. But that's, in a sense, that's the human condition, isn't it? It doesn't mean that you should therefore ignore it. You should do everything you can to learn from it and to do better next time. But you can't expect absolutely everything to be stopped all the time by a human organisation. You should make every effort to make, you know, every opportunity for learning and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, sometimes, and of course we have, you know, opponents, enemies out there who are trying very hard to make it difficult for the security forces and for the police and so on. And from time to time, sadly, it's likely that something won't go quite right.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
Your career spanned from the Cold War, as you've mentioned already, the standoff between the USA and the USSR. We then went through a period of the Gulf Wars, terrorist threats from Islamic extremists. And now we seem to be going back into a world with two axes, the sort of US-Europe, and then perhaps versus a coalition of maybe Russia, Iran, China, North Korea. And we've seen the tragedy unfold between Israel and Palestine, now Iran joining that with the drone attack. World peace is as fragile, I think, as I've ever known it. It's the top of my prayer list. How do we protect ourselves within this? Are we just going to be bystanders as things unfold? Or are there active things being done that we aren't aware of that could prevent us from sliding into something more catastrophic?
I think we are in a dangerous position, and you're quite right that I think, you know, the post-Cold War, not quite consensus, but, you know, hegemony of America really is falling away. Rising power of China, Russia going down a very negative and threatening route under its gangster regime, allying itself with China and with Iran, you know, joining that sort of gang. And I think this is a very threatening position. And, you know, it's demonstrated very clearly with the appalling events in Israel and Palestine over the last 6 or 7 months. So I think it is a worrying situation. I think the core of our security as a country and more widely really over the last generation has been in the sort of power of America, funnily enough. And America's not in a great place in a number of ways. I think if you look at the rhetoric and the behavior of Donald Trump, this is not something that certainly filled me with any great warm feelings. And it's, you know, one of those strange things that his support base in America appears to include a very large number of people who call themselves Christians, but his policy sort of, you know, slate, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't lend itself very well to those judgments. But anyway, so I think there is a lot to be concerned about at the moment. I always think back to the run-up to the First World War, where If you look at the cabinet minutes at that point in the UK, a war in Europe was not really one of the subjects they were discussing. They were discussing, as usual, Ireland. That was what they were worried about. And what actually then bowled them over was a war in Europe that they weren't really expecting. So we can't assume that we will not end up with wars. And who 5 years ago would have bet that there would be a full-scale shooting war in Europe, trench warfare, and so on, in the way that we're seeing. So, you know, there's no historical right to peace. You have to keep working towards it. We have to hope that, you know, diplomacy and cool heads can help to manage this situation in terms of immediate threats. There's no doubt that if you talk, and the current head of MI5 has made it very clear that, certainly during my time as Director General, the focus was almost not quite exclusively, but very heavily on counterterrorism. But now it's gone wider than that. There is a resurgence in state threats, a bit more like the period during the Cold War, but in a different context. So our defence and security system is adapting to this new environment. But, you know, power is much less concentrated and is more spread. And some of the people who have very considerable power in the world today are not countries whose value system is aligned with the one that we have traditionally had over the last couple of generations.
Christians often feel torn in this respect because we feel perhaps that every pound spent on rearming ourselves is a pound that's not available to sort out some social issue like poverty, global poverty. And yet wise people, wise commentators, who really know what they're talking about, Max Hastings, for example, has been calling for rearmament for some time. Do you feel that the whole of Europe needs to now take seriously the call to rearm?
Yes, I do. And the reason that I do is because we need to ensure that there is deterrence. What we want is peace. And if you are strong, if there are reasons to feel that an attack on a country is going to be costly or unsuccessful, then you won't launch the attack. And we have seen naked aggression, in my view, in Russia with the attack on Ukraine. We absolutely need to be in a position where NATO collectively, and there are other issues around NATO, but we need to be in a position where NATO's deterrent effect is strong in order to ensure that we do not have further wars in Europe. And if we are weak, if we're seen to be vulnerable, then that will be even more tempting, particularly to Mr. Putin. So I believe that we do need to rearm. I do believe that we need strong military capabilities as well as intelligence and security capabilities in order to avoid and to deter any risk of war. And obviously there is a cost in that because other things can't be paid for, but in the event that we do end up in a war, then the impact will be very, very much greater. If you look at the economic situation in Russia, was it 40% or something is being spent on defence? What? How much was being spent on defence as part of the UK's budget in 1944? You know, I think this is a time to invest in strong capabilities that can deter, rather than to find in 5 or 10 years that we are having to spend massively more to try and catch up in the face of immediate risk.
I want to turn now and think about, we've got the potential of a general election in the UK this year, and we're told that AI, deep fakes, social media are all making us vulnerable as voters. Does MI5 have a role in terms of protecting us from fake news that would swing an election?
I think that's a much wider thing than the role of MI5. I think there are aspects of this. If you look at, for instance, you know, what some states have been doing by way of deliberately trying to promote false narratives, that is a state threat, which I think our security system, our intelligence agencies are, you know, relevant to, because, you know, GCHQ can help to pull back the curtain and say, look, this is what is actually happening for all this stuff on some social media platforms and so on. And, you know, Robert Mueller in America produced a very interesting report on Russia, Russian influence in American public life, and gave, you know, great detail on it. So there are opportunities for where there are, particularly where there are state threats or organized threats. But I think we're faced with a much wider problem. And it's not just something where you can say, oh, well, you know, intelligence services ought to sort this out. I think there's a wider responsibility in owners of social media platforms in terms of government more widely. And we've seen attempts to legislate in this area with the Online Harms Bill. So the deliberate and pernicious national security aspects of this are important, but they are part of a much wider phenomenon. I mean, my committee, when I was the chair of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, did a report called Artificial Intelligence and Public Standards. Nothing really to do with national security issues, but I felt when I was coming into that role, that if you look at the way in which public services were delivered, increasingly artificial intelligence is going to be part of that. And what does that mean for accountability? What does that mean for objectivity? And we did a report looking at those aspects. So artificial intelligence, I think, is going to impact on our lives in all sorts of ways, for good and sometimes for, in risky ways. And we need to be thinking very carefully how we can get the best out of it without also creating lots of problems for ourselves by blindly assuming that the way in which it's operating is neutral, because it isn't always neutral. It depends on how you train it and, you know, how it is actually structured. So this is a much wider issue than just national security.
Now, I'm sure you're right to point out this is part of something far wider and far more systemic and sociological, because it seems that large groups of people are willing to go down a rabbit hole of untruth and believe really some fairly bizarre things about vaccines, perhaps, or a whole set of different aspects of modern life. And US evangelicalism, large swathes of that have actually gone into that rabbit hole, it seems. And so in a world where do people have a responsibility to protect themselves from, do we need to just be more skeptical, more questioning of what we see and hear and read about?
I'm sure we do. I find this whole conspiracy theory world baffling. I genuinely sort of puzzle over it because I just don't kind of get it. And now I recognize that's, in a sense, that's probably because I, you know, have a sort of different access to information to people than some people do. And I always used to feel like, you know, I'm not really a great believer in conspiracy theories, not least because presumably as the head of MI5, if there were any great big conspiracies, then I'd have been part of them. But of course, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you'd say, but you know, you would say that, wouldn't you? So, you know, you go back to the sort of Karl Popper thing about falsifiability, which probably, you know, most people in the street aren't particularly interested in Karl Popper. But, you know, the idea that you can't really believe in a theory unless there's some way of falsifying it, because otherwise, you know, how can you possibly establish and verify it? And a lot of the conspiracy theories are constructed and gamified in such a way that absolutely everything, once you've started to believe it, can be reconstrued to support your view. I genuinely am unclear as to how you stop this process if people are willing to go that way. And I applaud things like Full Fact for taking some of these theories and holding them up to the light. I applaud the BBC Verify for doing this. My slight worry is that some of the people who are most engaged in the sort of conspiracy world, I suspect, don't actually read BBC Verify, or they see it as part of the mainstream media conspiracy. So you sort of lose any handholds on reality, from my perspective. I think it's quite worrying how many people, and as you say, I mean, the extent to which some of the sort of QAnon conspiracy in the States appear to be attracting sympathy and interest amongst the evangelical church, you think, well, you know, kind of, this is, to my perspective and many people's perspective, self-evident, complete fiction. But there's something about the way in which information is delivered through social media that creates a difficulty in standing back and saying, you know, really? and I think we, you know, one of the things you have to do all the time, I suppose, in the intelligence world is to try as far as you can to stand back from the intelligence and say, really? Because, you know, you can get yourself all het up and heated, and you need to try and create that skepticism, challenge, etc., which arguably we rather, well, not we in MI5, but the, you know, the some parts of the intelligence community somewhat lost over the run-up to Iraq, for instance.
It's hard to see how democracy functions if people aren't being generally informed by generally reliable facts, and that is a worry, I think.
Yeah, I think you need, I mean, the idea of that you kind of share the facts and dispute the sort of policy implications of that is under significant threat. And as you say, the danger is you then become a sort of quasi-tribal society between those who happen to believe this conspiracy theory versus those who happen to believe that one, rather than shared facts, which you are then able to debate in a rational or interest-driven way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your chairmanship of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, and I just want to understand a little bit about the function and the scope of that committee.
Yeah, the committee is a strange thing. Like, you know, so many British bits of machinery, it's kind of grown up historically rather than anybody sitting down with a piece of paper and let's design one. If you cast your mind back to 1994, there was a standard scandal, the Cash for Questions scandal, and the then Prime Minister, John Major, invited Lord Nolan to write a report with a committee on standards in public life. And Lord Nolan, who was, of course, a very committed Christian, wrote his seminal work and published it, in which he articulated seven principles of public life and the systems and structures that should underpin the implementation of those principles. And John Major accepted that. And then the committee that Lord Nolan chaired then became a standing committee and still exists. So the role of the committee is to review the systems for managing and enforcing standards in public life and to provide advice to the Prime Minister on those areas. So it's not a committee that undertakes investigations into particular breaches. It sits above that and seeks to look at the totality of the system and judge whether it's working and how it could be improved.
Okay, well, so we look back over the last 20 years of Parliament, lockdown parties, lies, cash flow for influence. We look at the post office and the injustices inflicted by the leaders of the post offices on sub-postmasters. We look in gross failures in policing, meltdown in public utilities such as the water industry. Christians often tell me they despair about the people who lead us. So in your opinion, having been chairman of this committee, looking at the remit of standards in public life, what do you think has broken?
I don't think there has ever been a golden age of standards. The committee that I chaired was set up in 1994 because, you know, the allegations that MPs were taking cash in brown envelopes for asking questions turned out to be true. If you look back even further to, you know, the behaviour of previous political leaders. I mean, Winston Churchill wasn't, you know, a poster boy for ethical approach to his financial problems. Lloyd George wasn't exactly kind of spotless when it came to his personal behaviour and his willingness to exploit his political power for personal ends. So we shouldn't look back and think, oh, well, you know, 40 years ago, everything was marvellous and now it's terrible. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that there haven't been serious problems, and there have been serious problems. There is a slight irony in this, that the more openness you get, the more you pick up the stones, the more you see what's underneath them. And in a period of greater deference, and you know, then some of these things didn't become visible. If you look at, you know, some of the activities that were going on in the 1950s and 60s, you know, people knew they were happening, but they didn't ever get told to the public. Nowadays, they would get told to the public, and I think on the whole, that's a good thing. But ultimately, I always used to feel that when I first came into that role and thought about it, that there were two absolutely central kind of nodes in public standards. The first was the role of the Prime Minister in setting a tone and supporting the standard system. And the second was the seriousness with which the voters took these issues. Because if you elect a charlatan, then you will get charlatan-like behaviour. So there is a responsibility on all of us as voters and as citizens to give weight to public standards issues in the decisions that we make. And I think, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, I think that Boris Johnson, for a variety of reasons, you know, wasn't a prime minister who put great weight on public standards issues, partly, you know, for personal reasons. And, you know, I think that's been much commented on. But also, I think that there was a sort of ideology going around at that point, which said that, you know, we don't want all these, you know, grand figures who are going around pointing the finger at politicians. If people are elected to office, then the voter can decide whether they are the person that they want or not. So, you know, that's what matters here in terms of political accountability. Interestingly, the counter argument to the fact that the system is broken is that many of those cases, I mean, you know, arguably the Johnson government was actually brought down by the public standards failures in terms of cash for questions and Downing Street parties, the totally discreditable Owen Paterson episode, and really the political kind of credibility of the government was shot when those things were exposed. So in a sense, that kind of worked as a system.
And maybe as we're more aware of this being an issue in the quality of the governance we receive, hopefully it will be at the forefront of people's minds when they're making election decisions, voting decisions this year. I'd like to bring it into an area of public life that's close to the hearts of Premier, and that's church leadership. Many of us have lived through a range of abuse scandals, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, financial abuse, spiritual abuse. I remember early 1990s, the Sheffield 9 o'clock service was one of those situations. More recently, we've seen the leadership of the Christian Youth Festival Soul Survivor completely undermined by an emotional abuse scandal. And if I might actually plug Megan Cornwell's premier podcast, Soul Survivors, she's doing an excellent job at doing some sensitive investigative journalism to find out what went wrong in that particular case. For those of us who are on church councils, who have some oversight, holding leaders to account, can you give some advice about effective oversight to prevent breakdowns in leadership?
First thing I'd say is I think that Christian leadership is an exceptionally difficult role to take because you are engaged with people very often at their most vulnerable. There is an expectation of you, you know, as it were, modelling extraordinarily high standards and, you know, Christian ethics in a way which hardly any of us, if really held up to the microscope, would get a complete pass on. I suspect nobody would get a complete pass on it. And, of course, there are plenty of people who are willing to throw stones. Having said which, there have been some utterly appalling and egregious examples of abuse going on. And I think part of that comes to accountability. My own instinct and judgment, actually, and I've had a few conversations around some of this, is that there is a disinclination to have real accountability on the part of some Christian leaders, and particularly those who, you know, take the view that, you know, they are God ordained and, you know, they are God's representative in this parish. And, you know, so how can you, you know, call me to account because, you know, I'm God's representative? And they wouldn't say it like that, but there is some behaviours which kind of feel a bit like that. Mm-hmm. So you've really got to get to grips with this issue of accountability. And that is something which is for the church. Well, it depends on the denomination, of course, because, you know, the sort of Catholic and Anglican model is a bit different from the Free Church model or the independent churches model. But there has to be proper accountability. And anybody who is reluctant to be accountable for their actions and to give an account of the actions to the right people, I think that is a major problem. And I think it's a deep set cultural problem as well as a personal problem. sometimes I feel that the whole concept of ordination makes this worse, because it's, you know, I am a special person. Well, you know, the experience of the church over the last generation is that you can't take that as a strong answer. So accountability is critical. Independence, which goes along with accountability, I think is extremely important. I think the idea of the Anglican Church, you know, parish safeguarding officers who are independent of the ordained leadership, I think is very important. And providing opportunities for speaking up, which, again, the report, the committee I led did what I thought was an excellent report, drawn up largely by my colleagues, called Leading in Practice, which was about how, and it has a lot on how do you create the context within which people feel confident to speak up. And the two reasons people don't feel confident to speak up are, firstly, fear of the consequences, that in some way this will damage them or damage their credibility, or they will be pushed out of the kind of the club. Or futility, the feeling that, you know, it doesn't make any difference what I say because nobody will take any notice. So anybody thinking around this, I would say think about accountability. Think about the independent elements within the system and put a real focus on creating a context, not just a, you know, not just a kind of letterbox where you can put your note or a telephone number or something, but actually how do you actually create a cultural environment within which people feel that it is their responsibility and their right to speak up, because otherwise these things will go unreported because people think it's too scary or it's useless. That will mean taking quite a lot of different steps over time to change a culture, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, church culture very often has had an element of secrecy about it. I always used to think, you know, even in one of our churches that we went to, culturally it was more secretive than MI5 was. I don't mean in terms that it didn't handle the same material, but culturally there was a disposition to say, oh, well, don't talk about it. And that mm-hmm. doesn't make for a healthy organisation.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to end without mentioning your valuable work with Halo Trust you've taken on recently. Tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing there and the work that Halo does across the world.
Well, I was very excited when I was given the opportunity of taking over as chair of the Halo Trust. The Halo Trust is a British, a Scottish charity actually by origin, set up by two former military people, men, and the idea was that somebody needs to get into conflict zones after the conflict and clear up the mess, because the overhang of mines, explosives, military equipment from conflicts can go on for decades, and it blights people's life. It makes it impossible to rebuild the sort of society that one would want. Mines can remain in the ground active for literally for decades, blowing up children, stopping them getting to school, stopping people from, you know, farming in the area, creating a culture of sort of, you know, a context of fear. And their insight was that, you know, these were people who were used to things that go bang. Well, okay, let's get in there and let's take these out. And I think that's really the inspiration behind what Halo does today. It's become a very big organisation, nearly 12,000 staff, £160 million turnover this year, operating in 29 countries. A lot of those in the straightforward way of just having big programmes to take mines out of the ground. I was in Angola, you know, 6 weeks ago, in a minefield, and 50 yards from the edge of the minefield are women working in the fields with their children playing around their legs. So, and those are mines that have been there for 30 or 40 years. So Halo does that. It also does weapons and ammunition management. So, you know, leftover arms, which otherwise get used for crime and violence, you know, how can you actually take those out of circulation? And I think it's an inspirational organization. I think it is peacemaking. It's not just, you know, signing a deal. It is actually then doing the things that make peace real. And so I'm really inspired by the work that the people in Halo do. I think it is a huge contribution to improve the lives of some of the most vulnerable people in the world. It operates in very hazardous situations. And I think the people who are doing that work are remarkable.
I want to draw to a close now and just ask you to reflect on a professional life you've lived in the orbit of perhaps some of the darkest aspects of humanity. And how's that impacted on your personal faith? What would you feel now about your faith, having spent your life protecting the nation from some pretty dark things?
I have always felt that my, as it were, Christian duty was in the world more than in the church. And I strongly believe that Christians need to be involved in some of those difficult issues. I absolutely applaud Christians who are involved in church ministry. I applaud Christians who are involved in nursing and health and social care and all those things. I think that's absolutely tremendous. I also applaud Christians who are involved in the military, in, you know, the difficult the sort of darker aspects of life, and trying to bring light. You know, Christianity is about kingdom values, and it's about almost a sort of prophetic role. And there are many very good people in those darker areas trying to bring improvements. Some of them are Christians. Many of them, of course, aren't Christians or come from other faith groups. But I think it's really important that Christians should be in there and should be bringing their particular perspectives and insights to those difficult challenges which are part of the human condition.
And how have you been able to protect yourself from that? I think that's the heart of my question, because I think from my own perspective, as the world seems to be darker than it was even a decade ago, I find the weight of that quite hard to bear at times.
I would say three things on that. I think in MI5, and this isn't a particularly Christian point, the feeling of teamwork was really critically important, so that however difficult and bad the external events were, one did feel that you were in part of a supportive team and you did your best. And it was a non-judgmental environment in that sense. And I think that's critically important to maintain people's sense of proportion. I've, you know, from a purely personal point of view, family life is actually more important, I would say, probably to one's general well-being than professional life. And I've been enormously, you know, lucky in my wife and in my children and other members of the family and friends who have been supportive. And finally, I have actually had, you know, the benefit of being involved in church community, who again have been a support. I can remember, you know, only a little tiny anecdote really, but I can remember at one point when we were subject to a lot of criticism in some of the newspapers for allegations around the service's activities. And I went to church on Sunday morning and, you know, a little lady, godly lady, of whom there are so many in churches, came up to me and sort of patted me on the arm and said, "Oh dear, you know, we saw all those things they were saying about you, but we think you're doing a very good job." And actually, you kind of feel that's kind of possibly slightly more the authentic voice of people in sort of the country than some of the stuff you get in central London. So I've always found that, you know, the support of local Christian community as well as those other areas as being very positive from my point of view.
Thank you, Lord Evans, for your insights today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.